I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. It's 4 years ago today that Donetsk and Luhansk rejoiced while watching a historic TV address by Russia's President Vladimir Putin when he finally declared his decision to recognize those two regions as independent, nearly 8 years after they broke away after a CIA-backed coup in Ukraine. Days later, Russian troops were sent into the Donbass region to liberate residents who had lived in a conflict zone all that time. No one could have predicted that 4 years later, the region would still be a war zone, continued by a Western Europe whose leaders have never set foot in the area as they pour their people's money into a proxy war they can't win, but through which they can catalyze the end of the world. But this week, to avert the prospect of nuclear war, the first trilateral talks between Ukraine, Russia, and the USA were held in Western Europe, in Geneva, Switzerland. Joining me again from Washington, D.C. is Professor Anatol Levin, director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's a former senior associate for foreign and security policy at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and was on the academic board of the Valdai Discussion Club throughout the 80s and 90s. He worked as a journalist in the former Soviet Union, other areas of Eastern Europe and in South Asia. Professor Levin, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Obviously, in this region, minds are more concentrated, arguably, on a huge proportion of the United States military 100 miles away in the Gulf. But let's get to the trilateral talks. Before we get to your assessment of those, though, just looking back 4 years, what has been the impact on Western European civic society, on the peoples of Western Europe of nearly 4 years since this Russian recognition of Donetsk and Luhansk, nearly 8 years after the Kiev coup, $360 billion sent to Ukraine from Western European people's money?
Well, I mean, the Russian invasion, of course, set off a wave of hysteria, really, in Western and Central Europe, across the political spectrum, the left as well as the right. And there was tremendous outpouring of support for Ukraine. Security establishments signed up to it totally, of course. Very convenient, very comfortable for them, in a way, to go back to the Cold War syndromes and you know, in which their institutions had been created. And of course, the Biden administration in America really fostered this. Now, of course, since then, Trump has come to power, and that has left the Europeans in a very uncomfortable position. They have committed themselves, in theory, verbally, completely to Ukraine. But of course, when they did that, it was in the conviction that they had the complete support of the United States. Now they no longer do. Now, of course, under Trump, the US is basically telling them that, you know, over time, but possibly not a very long time, they will have to take the chief responsibility for their own defense and for paying for their own defense, which they have, once again, verbally agreed to. But, of course, every budget in Europe is under intense pressure from the effort to maintain social services amidst economic stagnation. And where the money is going to come from, I mean, where the money is going to come from for Ukraine if this war goes on for another year, is very unclear. But they seem to have trapped themselves, you know, through their language, in a situation where they cannot now back down and seek, you know, a genuine compromise peace in Ukraine. Because if they were to do that, I mean, of course, this is by no means just their fault. I mean, Russia is still making at least one demand, which the Ukrainians cannot satisfy. But if the Europeans were to...
What demand is that?
...offer serious... Sorry?
What demand is that?
The demand that the Ukrainians withdraw from the whole of the Donbass. They still hold a small slice of it. And that is politically, it seems, impossible for the Ukrainians to do. But of course, as you said... when Trump went to war in 22, the chief argument for this was the need to liberate the whole of the Donbass and to save the people of the Donbass from... But of course, that makes it very difficult for Putin to make peace now without even having, in the Russian phrase, liberated the whole of the Donbass.
Yeah, but then has it surprised you that the noises coming from the Munich Security Summit, that hotel in Munich, they didn't seem to respond to the changing circumstances in a way that you would suggest that they're all very aware of? I mean, what did you as a scholar do as you hear that Mark Rutte, of the titular head of NATO here, it says, we are Russia's next target and we are already in harm's way. I mean, do you think he is deliberately lying obviously it would be broadcast in media across Western Europe that Russia is about to invade the whole of Western Europe. Is he lying? Are these leaders lying and dangerously lying? Or are they actually these elites in Western Europe and the people represented at the Munich Security Summit deranged?
I think some of them are deliberately lying. Many of them are lying to themselves. And then, of course, you have the syndrome that the security services, the military services, you know, as the saying goes, you know, it's their job to be paranoid, to think of worst-case scenarios. And of course, thinking of worst-case scenarios gets them a lot more money. The politicians, I mean, take our own beloved Starmer, know absolutely nothing of military affairs, virtually nothing of international affairs, certainly nothing of Russia. And so they believe whatever the generals and admirals tell them. But there is another point, which is that, the European armed forces were allowed or encouraged to decline very radically over the past 30 years. Britain can now just about mobilize one brigade, two submarines, at a time. And so there is this belief that Europe needs to increase its defenses, especially with America now looking more and more unreliable. But of course, how to persuade electorates to accept much higher military spending when, as I say, every budget in Europe is under intense pressure and the economies are stagnant? Well, it seems a lot of people think that the only way is to terrify the people by trying to convince them that the Russian bear is coming to eat their children. But I'm not sure that this is really working because, when you sit in Paris in a cafe and some security expert says, actually, we are already at war with Russia and, Russia is waging war against us. And you look around, and you look at all the other people in the cafe and in the restaurants next door and the tourists. No. And I mean, there is a sense among Western European publics that this is vastly exaggerated.
Yeah, perhaps I'm a bit unkind saying Western Europe. I mean, Western European elite when I'm talking about these threats almost. And poll ratings, Macron, 80% of the French population against him. Starmer, 75% against him. Merz, 69% against him. Meloni, 57% against her. 65% against Sanchez of Spain. There's a latest YouGov polling. Why would the elites cling on against their own electoral concerns to these ideas of security analysts when they could electorally benefit, arguably, as have often, more often than not, the right in these Western European countries? Why does that not make them think?
Well, I mean, actually, the one area where Starmer retains some public respect and support has been his stance on foreign policy and Russia. Because, of course, on that, the British media, who are by now extraordinarily subservient to the security services, actually do agree with Starmer and support him. So I fear that this is actually a way of, trying to cling to, as you say, the tattered remnants of his domestic prestige. But also, I think they've got themselves into a mood, and once again, perhaps as much lying to themselves as lying to the public, whereby, you know, if you can convince people, as they've been trying to for years, that these right-wing and left-wing populist parties are working for Moscow, you know, are in Putin's pocket, maybe that is a way of blocking them from coming to power. Because we've already seen, you know, in Romania, how this charge of, you know, the opposition working for Moscow was used to disqualify them or to disqualify their candidate. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in Germany of using the, you know, support, the supposed Russian support for the radical right party, AfD, to ban AfD. So that I think, you know, once again, either cynically or maybe through this mood of hysteria, you know, the old trick of accusing your domestic opponents of being traitors, of being national traitors, has proved very useful in the past. And I fear that a good many establishment politicians in Europe are now tempted by that.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump obviously knows all about that after the Russia hoax. On the trilateral talks, Jonathan Powell, it's been my misfortune to be on TV shows with him and Sir Keir Starmer. Powell is a national security advisor to the British Prime Minister. There were pictures all over social media of him playing with a teapot at the Intercontinental Hotel in Geneva. Why? Just explain, why were the British in Geneva at all?
They're trying to look important. You know, this is a fundamental, an absolutely fundamental driving impulse of the US, of the British establishment, and especially, of course, the British foreign and security establishment, the desperate desire to look important, to seem to play a big role on the world stage. I mean, to be in the room, even if actually you have nothing to say.
And as to why it was in Geneva in the first place, there were rumors that that Zelensky was annoyed with the government of the UAE, where I'm speaking to you from, because of the extradition of the UAE extradited to Russia, Lyubomir Korba, alleged attempted assassin of Lieutenant General Vladimir Alexeev, the deputy head of the GRU. So Zelensky changed the location of the talks. We shouldn't necessarily think that it being in Western Europe is significant, that Western Europe is at last playing its role on the world stage again.
No, I mean, the location of these events doesn't really matter in my view. What matters is who's in the room and, you know, what offers or demands are on the table. And most unfortunately, at present, on this territorial issue, and also it seems still on the security guarantees to Ukraine, the two sides are too far apart to reach an agreement. That's why I say that if the Europeans really wanted to try and play a positive role, they would, for example, offer to lift or suspend sanctions against Russia in return for Russia dropping the territorial demand. They would agree to start buying Russian energy again, which is very much in their own interest. But of course, after 4 years of demonizing Russia, claiming that, you know, Russia's ambitions extend to conquering Paris and London, very difficult for them to do that without obviously looking pretty stupid.
Professor Anatole Levin, I'll stop you there. More from the director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Professor Anatole Levin. Professor, we were talking about lessening of sanctions. Energy supplies, it's very shadowy as to whether, in fact, Russia was supplying energy to Ukraine during all of this war, and let alone to Britain, say, in the way that the energy markets work, but the populations aren't told anything about it. And who knows, by now, by the time this is broadcast, maybe there has been some kind of sanction relief. But amidst all of that, the UK, Swedish, German, Dutch governments all came out proudly talking about Ecuadorian frog poison and in relation to the death of Alexei Navalny, who in this region, an Islamic region in Ramadan, knows of as a far-right activist in Russia who wanted to exterminate Muslims. I mean, what did you think of the frog poison story, which was emblazoned across Western Europe as if, I mean, even the Americans, US intelligence had concluded it wasn't anything to do with frog poison. What did you make of that?
Well, I have to say, look, the circumstances of Navalny's death were suspicious, certainly. And, you know, the Russian government has certainly used assassination as a weapon. But as you say, the initial American report said that there was no sign of poison. And it is obviously pretty suspicious that it should have taken them 2 years to come up with this. And obviously, you know, unfortunately, over the past generation, we have seen, you know, so many stories generated by Western intelligence services that have turned out to be fakes, that sadly, one cannot take anything that they now say simply at face value. And not myself being an expert on frog poison.
What a shame. What a shame, Professor. I was really hoping for that, clearly.
I can't say.
So perhaps the alienation will be the Zelensky corruption within Ukraine, at least, to an extent. I mean, Slovakia declared a state of emergency over disruption at the Druzhba pipeline. And Ukraine just says, you know, we need to repair it. There are elections in Hungary and Parliament in April the 12th, in Slovakia, communal ones on March 21st. How do you see countries that are not full-heartedly in support of this theory that Moscow wants to invade London and Paris, how are they going to further destabilize those other countries that refuse to fall in line? Well, they fall in line with the American policy, arguably, but they refuse to fall in line with London and Paris and Berlin.
Well, I mean, I think the biggest question is whether Paris will cease to be in line with Paris, if you see what I mean. French presidential elections next year, the betting is really on the radical right party, the Rassemblement National, winning the presidency. And then we will have to see, because although they fell into line with the NATO response to the Russian invasion, it is no secret that many of them, you know, they really want to prioritize domestic issues, migration. They don't regard Russia as a threat. And of course, they're also very close to Trump and MAGA in the US. So that if France switches, then, well, the coalition of the willing will collapse. And also, they no longer want to leave the European Union, but they are certainly against the centralization of the European Union that we have seen in recent years. And they are absolutely determined that defense and foreign policy should remain national prerogative.
And there are tensions between France and Germany as well, even before any elections.
Well, even at present. Yeah, I mean, even at present, there are tensions between France and Germany because, of course, France wants to, you know, really build up its industries through this rearmament. Germany, you know, is more anxious just to rearm. And there is obviously huge competition between French and German industry. So, you know, Europe once again has committed itself to, you know, these military policies. It's committed, my God, it's even committed itself to Ukrainian membership of the European Union, which can only happen if they either create, which they're now talking about, a second or even third tier European Union, or if they simply tear up the existing terms of admission. So, I mean, the Europeans have talked themselves into a series of corners, and well, we have to see how the elections go in the years to come. There are also elections in Eastern Germany, state elections this year, which could see AfD winning big majorities. That will radically destabilize the existing German political system and call Germany's commitment to all this into question.
Do you think the peoples of Western Europe, it's not only the impoverishment that the Ukraine conflict has caused the peoples of Western Europe to completely mean that the leaders are completely out of touch, but the whole idea of liberalism within Western Europe, it seems a bit of a, I mean, their reaction to what Trump said about Greenland, for instance, or the kidnapping of Maduro and Celia Flores of Venezuela, it's all gone out the window, this idea of rule of law and liberal values and so on. And it's very difficult for the peoples of Western Europe to believe their leaders.
Well, that's it. I mean, and starting, of course, with the financial crisis in 2008, or possibly even starting with the Iraq war. But all the existing elites, the economic elites, the security elites, have, I mean, not just faced, but to a great extent created a series of disasters which has discredited them in the eyes of the population and discredited the existing establishments. So there is, yes, I mean, just a general loss of faith in the existing ruling European establishments. And of course, also because of the manifest hypocrisies and the, you know, pretty shameful open lying, above all, I would say, over Gaza, because, you know, they are still talking about, you know, Russian war crimes and even talking about Russian genocide in Ukraine, whereas, of course, all the European governments have acquiesced in, well, not all of them, some honourable exceptions, Ireland, Spain, but most have acquiesced in what Israel has been doing. And, you know, that has also, you know, really undermined respect for them. Well, at least on the left of the spectrum. But of course, several of these governments are social democratic, Labour Party in Britain. And their younger supporters or ex-supporters, just there's just a mood of kind of a mixture of weariness and disgust, I would say.
Yeah, it's an issue that certainly focuses the minds of the entire global south, the ongoing genocide. But then in these circumstances, and you intimated about their interference in Romania, surely France, the elites there can do all sorts of electoral tricks to prevent the right from winning because of the peculiarities of the de Gaulle system. But there can be false flags. There can be all sorts of other maneuvers these elites can arrange to prevent them losing because it's all or nothing for them. Should people watching this be very wary of what happens in the next few months? They're not going to just accept defeat, are they, these elites?
No, well, I mean, they've already disqualified Marine Le Pen on what looks very much like, frankly, a legal technicality. But actually going as far as rigging the elections or declaring a state of emergency, that would be difficult in France because there is so much support for Rassemblement National. And since, unlike AfD, they're an old party and they have, you know, they now hold office across much of provincial France. You know, they rule big cities and big regions. So that move would be extremely dangerous.
I mean, back in Britain, our country, you know, reform is dominating the polls, and they clearly they're being painted as a Russian front by the Starmer government, Nigel Farage, as Starmer himself has dispatched HMS Prince of Wales for Operation Firecrest into the Arctic. I suppose I should just ask you, what on earth is the British warship being, why are they sending a British warship into the Arctic?
Well, you know, I mean, it's supposedly to deter a possible Russian.
Is there any imminent threat from China and Russia in the Arctic that will affect the lives of ordinary people from Britain?
Well, I don't think there's any imminent, there is no imminent threat. I mean, the melting of the ice means that more commercial ships couldn't sail through. But I mean, throughout the Cold War, you had nuclear submarines swimming around under the ice and popping up every now and again. I mean, this idea that the Russians are going to invade Svalbard or somehow threaten to occupy Greenland is such, I mean, unbelievable nonsense. No Russian is talking about that. What could they possibly gain? But also, of course, I mean, this is the crazy thing. Some of the same military experts, my God, in Britain, on the one hand, say that the Russian army is so weak and so demoralized, and, you know, the Russian fleet has been defeated by the Ukrainians, who have no fleet at all, by missiles and drones. And they say, you know, Russia is so weak that if we only give some more support for the Ukrainians and, you know, reject peace and carry on, Russia will collapse. So Russia is very weak. On the other hand, Russia is so strong and the Russian Navy is so strong that it can attack Norway and occupy Svalbard and threaten Britain. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to see that combination as anything other than deliberately mendacious.
And just finally and briefly, obviously one big catalyst for change has been Trump. Any last minute things these Western European elites can do to destroy Donald Trump? They were involved, obviously, in the Russia hoax previously. Can they stop him?
I think they'd be too scared to do that now. You know, Trump does not forgive attacks easily. And they are still, as Reuters, you know, subservience shows, Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, they do still feel this deep, deep dependence on the US. And of course, they're terrified that if they do that, Trump really will seize Denmark and inflict total humiliation on them. So no, I don't think they dare.
Professor Anatol Levin, thank you.
Pleasure.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those suffering the impact of the US-UK-EU armed bombing of Donbass and in this region, Gaza. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Monday with the UN ambassador to Cuba as Trump seeks to destroy the island beacon of the Global South emboldened after his kidnapping of Venezuelan President Maduro and his First Lady Celia Flores. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.